danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 296 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from somewhere in Maryland probably is Andrew Brokus. How are you, Andrew?
I'm good. I'm still in Maryland for another, won't even be 2 weeks now before I'm going out to Las Vegas.
I'm excited for you. I'm excited for you.
There's going to be some tournaments going on out there this summer, so I think I'll check that scene out and see if anybody else shows up.
It is the capital of the poker world for 3 months a year, that's for sure. So that's.
I realized I did not share with you the. I made a shareable document with our hand histories for today, and I realized I didn't share it with you.
Wait. You know, sometimes. Actually, let's try something today, lad. So don't share it with
you
me.
And all. Blind?
I sometimes like what I standardly do is read through everything and then try not to look at results. But can I try these blind?
Sure, works for me.
Fantastic.
So how are things?
Things are good. Beautiful day here in Melrose. And I got the cat next to me looking outside. He's very excited. There are lots of birds out for the spring, so that gives the cat somebody to harass. And there's snakes and turkeys and foxes and all sorts of stuff running around outside. Yeah, it's really quite amazing. After years of being closer to Boston proper, I'm just a couple miles up the highway here, and that makes all the difference in terms of things like air quality and whether or not you might see a fox on your morning walk. So, no, it's very nice. Spring is here, and that is lovely. And how are you?
I'm pretty good. I was I'm kind of in the final push of trying to get this book finished. I'd like to. I say this book as though everyone knows what I'm talking about. I've mentioned it a little bit on Twitter and in my newsletter, which you can sign up for at thinkingpoker.net/newsletter. But I don't think it looms as large in the mind of our audience as it does in my mind right now. So I've been working on this book, which is meant to be a practical introduction and guide to using game theory. I'm thinking of subtitling it Game Theory for People Who Think They Don't Need Game Theory or something along those lines. I think there's a lot that understanding, you know, we're not really talking about making sense of like Pyo solver results here or getting exact frequencies right. It's more just sort of how can understanding some of the fundamental concepts in game theory help you better make sense of, you know, poker and even to formulate exploitive strategies, which is what you should be doing most of the time. Like, I think a lot of people kind of use it as an excuse to say, oh, well, my opponents are bad, so I don't use game theory. I just play, you know, exploitively against my opponents, which is great and is what you should be doing. But I think a lot of people overestimate the number of cases in which they actually know what is the best exploitive play. You know, sometimes even if you know your opponent's making a certain mistake, I mean, we get hand histories all the time where people will sort of incorrectly identify what they should be doing to take advantage of that particular mistake. And then there's plenty of cases where, like, even if you know that your opponent is, for instance, too loose on the river, you know, what does that tell you about how you should be responding to his turn bets? And now it actually does tell you something, which is you maybe have a little more incentive to get to the river against this player, you know, holding strong hands if you have like a draw on the turn. You might have better implied odds if you know your opponent is too loose on the river or something. But you know, I think a lot of people, for instance, if your opponent is betting too much on the turn, a good exploit for that is like check raising the turn more aggressively. And I did think a lot of people, you know, don't do that.
Yeah. Also, by the way, sometimes if your opponent is too light, too loose on the river, you tighten up on the turn. just by the way, and that's the right way to do it. So I fully agree. I fully agree. There's a lot that people should know and do not about game theory. And I, for one, am looking forward to reading the book.
Anyway, where I was going with all that is writing a book sucks. It was a terrible idea. And I want to find somebody to blame. Like, I wanted to be like, Nate, why didn't you tell me not to write this book? But the truth is, I didn't really tell anybody I was doing it until it was already, like, very well underway. But yeah, it's a lot of hours going into this, and I don't think the hourly rate is going to end up being all that good. Reminding myself that I've learned things along the way. Like, I've gotten some surprising results, even in cases where I thought I knew what the result was going to be, because I'm not doing anything super complicated. The structure of the book is like looking at some, I call them scenarios. So some of them are toy games, like the Ace King Queen game or variants on that. And some of them are like actual poker scenarios where I give you like these are the starting ranges of both players and encourage you to make some predictions about both what unexploitable strategy might look like and then also how to exploit certain mistakes that a player might make either in a toy game or in a real poker scenario. So in all these cases, I was using solvers. Like I kind of already had an idea of what point I wanted to convey with each scenario that I put together. But then I did use solvers to like double check that I was right about the results, and like there were cases where I got surprising outcomes that I had to like stop and make sense of them for myself, and I did learn things in that process. So I'm trying to convince myself that sort of there's like this nebulous variable I get to add on, which is like the learning experience of writing the book. And if I add that to the money made from the book, then maybe writing this book will turn out to have not been such a catastrophe. But yeah, really a lot of time has gone into this book.
Yeah, yeah. Writing books and other financial catastrophes. I mean, I think the thing to do now is to work on it exclusively at 6 in the morning when good games aren't running and you also don't have, like, coaching. So at least you can tell yourself that you're monetizing time that otherwise you would not have been monetizing.
Yeah, there's some of that.
The tone of voice there was just absolutely perfect. You know, it's good. It's good for the soul. It's good for the soul. I mean, I wrote a PhD dissertation, which was read by almost every member of my committee. And, that's a joke. I'm sure they all read it. That's there are. There are worse ways financially to write long things, let me tell you.
Fair enough. So the other problem is, I mean, part of what took so long was that I really overwrote the book initially, and I ended up kind of like slicing it in half. And then, so, you know, what I'm going to end up publishing is really only the first half of what I wrote initially. But even that, to sort of turn it from the first half of a book into a coherent whole of its own, has required a decent amount of kind of revising and rewriting and whatnot. So then there's still, like, even as I'm saying all this about writing a book being a terrible idea, there's still like a very clear sequel out there, which is the second half of what I wrote, that's just like floating around laughing at me and being like, I could be a sequel. And I know, really, like, funny. You know what I mean? I feel like I'm gonna end up writing a sequel.
It's calling to you. You know, writing is good for the soul. I also think there's like an underrated good thing there, which I now strongly believe about creative projects, which is like, do it first, then talk about it. I think that's the right way to do it. I think that's the right way to write a book.
You definitely can find the opposite advice, where it's sort of like, once you publicly commit to doing something, you're more likely to like stick through doing it, which I guess is probably why I was reluctant to, you know, until I had already like gotten far enough, which is the same thing I did. You know, we've talked about the origin story of this podcast before, but you know that I had a very short-lived solo podcast that never got released or talked about, because it was kind of like, I wanted to make sure it was going to be viable before I talked about it. And I did the same thing with the book, but yeah, I mean, you could definitely find people suggesting to do exactly the opposite.
Yeah. I'll say for me, and I think for a lot of people like me, it helps, like, not only it keeps my head in like a clear spot. It's there's a kind of interiority that's not possible if I'm talking about something publicly. So but you know, good for you. It's good for the soul. I think my own guess is that in 5 years you're going to feel better about having written this book.
I think that's true.
Yeah. So like, Yeah, in certain branch of analytic philosophy, this is called the reflection principle, the idea which people debate, that like, if you think that tomorrow you're going to believe something, maybe you should just believe it today. Like, it seems wrong to say, like, you know, tomorrow I'm going to believe that Paris is the capital of France. Like you should believe now that Paris is the capital of France if you think that. So, yeah, you should be happy now. You should be happy now.
Actually, I have a cousin who told his mother, I don't know, maybe like 6 years old or something, he told her, I still believe in Santa Claus, but I don't think I will next year.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, it's it reminds me of that wonderful prayer of attributed to Augustine, Saint Augustine. It's a Lord, give me chastity, only not yet.
Yeah. So yeah, the book is the main thing I have in the works. The other big project that was way more fun and less time consuming and will end up being more lucrative than the book was these premium podcasts that Carlos and I just put out, and those are available in the Knitcast store now, which is at knitcast.com. This is about 4 hours of Carlos and me, you know, kind of joking around, having fun, and talking about strategy specifically for single table tournament satellites, single table satellites, like of the sort that run during the World Series of Poker. Although I do think a decent amount of what we're talking about is sort of like general short stacked strategy. There's some general satellite strategy in there. So I guess I'm always, I don't want people to get too much of a narrow idea of like, oh, if I don't play a single table of satellites, then this is of zero interest to me whatsoever. It's certainly of reduced interest to you, but I think there is some a decent amount of more broadly applicable. Plus there's Carlos, you know? There's
yep.
Carlos. We've got episode 300 coming up, as you might guess from the fact that this is episode 296. We would really like to share your poker stories on episode 300, and there's two ways that you can share those with us. You can send them to podcast@thinkingpoker.net, or if you would like to hear your voice on the show and understand that you will receive no financial compensation for that and will be granting us the rights to put your voice on the show and broadcast it as part of this podcast, you can make a Skype call to Thinking Poker on Skype. Nobody's going to answer. You're just going to get a voicemail, and you can leave a message of you telling your poker story. And if we like your poker story and find it entertaining or insightful, we will put it on episode 300. And we, obviously, we really appreciate everybody sharing their stories, but mostly we appreciate everyone who has shared the experience of this podcast with us for the last, it's been almost 7 years now we've been doing this.
Yeah, it's wild. I went back on Twitter, which I think you saw, and dug up like the email I sent you 7 years ago when...
Oh, no, I didn't see this.
Yeah. I mean, I screen capped it, and yeah, it's like, hey, you know, I know your podcast didn't work out. Do you want to try one? And like, it's an email I sent you 7 years ago asking if you wanted to start a podcast or try starting a podcast.
Speaking of financial catastrophes.
Oh, yeah, no, terrible. But, you know, life win.
This is one that 7 years later I'm grateful for.
Yeah, me too. I'm binging on Billions these days, and it's like holy shit, the guy who wrote this also wrote Rounders, or co-wrote Rounders, co-wrote that, and also occasionally listens to the show. Like,
and was on the show.
Holy crap. Sorry?
And was on the show.
And was on the show, yes. And was on the show, and, you know... And if I tweet a bad opinion about REM, he'll probably smack me down for it. You know, all these things. it's a very good life choice.
Our strategy sponsor is Tournament Poker Edge. There is a lot of exciting new stuff over at Tournament Poker Edge. We've got a hand history review from former Thinking Poker guest Killing Bird, and Mark Aliotto. There's also some new material from Colin Moshman, from Alex Fitzgerald, also both previous guests of this podcast, and from yours truly, Andrew Brokus, and that's just on the front page. So you can only imagine scrolling through years of archives on Tournament Poker Edge how much great material you're going to find, and you can get access to it for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com.
That's how long we've been doing this show, is like you say Colin Moshman and I forget he was on the show.
All right, first hand comes to us from Chris. Chris says, hey guys, interesting spot with a tough villain for my regular 5-5 game. Villain is a bad lag, very splashy, not a total idiot post-flop, but simply plays too many hands at all times from everywhere for raises and calls to make too many hands to make money. He's been a very active squeezer, but more on the dangerous side post-flop. He's not a total punter. Don't think we've played before, and I've been pretty tight and not very active tonight. But when I've played hands, I've been aggressive pre and post with very few showdowns, if any. So probably normal tag reg image. So this is a 5-5 game. The hero is 5 off the button with ace-king offsuit. Opens to 25. The main villain in the hand, the player just described, calls 2 off the button, or the hijack. The button and both blinds call. I don't know if there's too much interesting to say pre-flop.
Well, I mean, can I say one thing about the description? Mm-hmm. Is that, like, if the main villain is someone who you know this well, if he's got his eyes open, he's also played much more with you than just this one session. So if this were, I'm not saying anything about Chris, but if this were a student coming to me about this hand, I would say, why are you so focused on your image with this guy from this 1 hour? Like, do you think he's going to be so fixated on just what you've been doing this last hour? Or have you just been tight and are you like looking for an image? Are you looking for an excuse? I would worry that the rest of this hand is going to be somebody saying, well, I've been tight and aggressive so far, so I can run a bluff now.
Right.
And like, and especially like you say, like, oh, I know all this stuff about my regular opponent, but the relevant thing that he knows about me is how I've played the last 25 hands of poker. Like, that's like an asymmetry. And in fact, people often do overweight how you've played the last hour of poker. And even a lot of regs are paying no attention to, like, what you've done. Like, a lot of regs do not have a great memory for you. However, I'm just saying, like, psychologically, putting on my coach hat, some flags are going up here.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a fair concern. So we are 5 ways to the flop with our hero holding ace king offsuit and the flop ace of spades, 6 of diamonds, 5 of hearts.
And by the way, I've still never seen this hand before, so that's, you know, just by the way, I'm not looking at results. This is totally new to me. Okay, ace 6-5, 5 to the flop, boom.
Both blinds check. What's your play?
Well, so we're 5 handed, so we're probably not going to be so. Again, what would I tell a student? Forget you have ace-king. You raised, a lag called, button called, both blinds called, the flop came, ace-6-5, rainbow. What should your betting range here look like? Like, well, on the one hand, the board's a little bit connected. On the other hand, it's not like that easy to beat a hand like ace-jack or ace-queen on this board. So, like, you should... And you also don't want to give too many free cards for no reason. Give a free draw to, you know, gut shots and five outers, hands like that. So I don't think you should just be blasting away with nothing, but I do think that the initial raiser has a pretty good advantage on this board. And that includes, like, a nuts advantage, especially, so 5 off the button. Would you have raised pocket 5s and pocket 6s from that spot? Probably yes. So that's very important. So, I mean, the big worry is that if you bet here, like, can, say, the big blind just decide he has a nuts advantage over you, and you, almost never have a hand better than one pair, and he can just, you know, start check raising with impunity. That's a that if that were true, then it would be bad to bet. But I think that none of these players has a big nuts advantage over you, so I think it's okay to bet even a hand like ace jack for you know, some combination of value and protection and all that. I wouldn't bet all my combinations of ace jack. So I think ace king is a good hand to have in a betting range, at least sometimes. If you want to think about combinations to check with, maybe the ones with like the ace king suiteds with three flushes. Since I don't have the hand in front of me, I don't have all the suits in front of me, but my guess is that I think this is a pretty good spot to bet in. You know, it's always a little bit dangerous to bet into a five-way pot. And again, on the psychological side, when you have ace-king and you're the pre-flop raiser, it's very easy to say, like, oh, man, if I bet, everybody's just going to know exactly what I have. They don't know what you have. They don't know what you have. It's not that easy to make ace king. Think of all the other times that an ace come and you're like, fuck, why can't I have ace king, right? You know, it's like, you know, it's not that easy to have ace king on an ace high board. So I think I would bet probably around, the pot's pretty bloated. I think like half the pot sounds about right. But I'm rusty. Hey, Andrew, what would you do?
So I think I mostly agree with your analysis. I think maybe the one thing I want to emphasize is, you know, when it comes to like, everyone's going to know I have ace king, there's also a question of, so what? Like, does that mean someone's folding ace jack to a bet? No. Like, no one is just going to be like, oh, he obviously has ace king, I just fold ace jack. I mean, I have done that against people, but like, you, like, A, our hero probably doesn't have the image where I would do that against him anyway, and B, most opponents are not going to do that. Like, they're not calling with an ace in their hand so they can fold when an ace flops, even if they should maybe think about doing it, which they should if your bet is too big. Like, if you fire like 100 here, I think it actually is a fold with a hand like ace jack. But again, I think a lot of people are going to struggle to do that. But certainly for a smaller bet, you know, you should be getting peeled by dominated aces. And I mean, the biggest concern is, you know, potentially getting raised by a polarized range, which immediately, you know, reduces the value of your hand to something approximating zero. But as you say, Nate, you know, it's not that easy to just assume you have nothing. Like, you shouldn't be c-betting all that often in this spot, just in a five-way pot. Like, you're restricted in how much c-betting you can do, period. And you should have some stronger hands in your range, including, if not lower sets, which I think is, I mean, many people will raise those, especially if we're using a 5x open. I don't know that I would really want to have those in my opening range, but regardless, like ace 5 suited, ace 6 suited, pocket aces, you know, these are all hands in your range. And I mean, you're still going to be somewhat, like, that's not really enough to completely protect you from getting raised by a polarized range, but it's not trivial either for your opponents to just come after you.
Yeah. And also, very important, I don't think we have all the stack sizes here, but this is a five-way pot for five big blinds each. So, like, the nuts don't need to be that nutty. It'd be different if the stack-to-pot ratio were, like, 17, but it's not.
Actually, it's 1.5K effective, so it's like 12.
Yeah. So, I mean, still very deep, but big difference between 12 and 20, and, like, it really does matter. Like, ace king is still a lot closer to the nuts than it would be in a heads up pot.
Yeah.
Let's just say.
So yeah, I mean, I think the main thing in general, I think you don't want to use particularly big sizing in multi-way pots, particularly on a board like this one that's pretty, you either have it or you don't. You know, I mean, there's a few draws out there, but like, there's not flush draws, the straight draws are on the low side, and just with, like, it's just hard to have equity on ace high boards, you know, like there's no overcards. So like, when you do have an ace, it's hard for people to peel without one. You know, it's hard for a hand like king jack of diamonds to peel this flop, even with backdoor straight draw, backdoor flush draw. There's just like, it's so unlikely that you're going to win the pot by hitting a king or a jack that you're, and I'm not to mention, and it's like a five-way pot, so even if someone doesn't believe you, there's still the risk of like three other people in the pot. So it's just like, it's very hard. Like, even when people are getting a good price, like even if they are getting 4-to-1 or something, it's, you can't really justify appealing with hands like king jack of diamonds. So I think this is typically a spot to use a small, if anything, I would probably want to do even less than half pot, like 40 or something.
That seems good. So since we're so deep, I need to say something about preflop. If your opponents are any good at all, if you're playing this deep, like just like randomly, not randomly, but using this big array size from early position with it's bad. It's bad. With a wide range, it's bad. With a narrow range, it's bad. You will get screwed. Like, it's, you don't want to do that. Like, if you raise and you get called and you're that deep, not good. Don't. Hey, do you agree with me here?
Yeah, I do. I think there's actually, I mean, this is, I think there can be a case for limp raising more in these spots. Like, even when you have pocket aces, like, I mean, obviously, like, everyone's big fear of, like, limping with aces. Like, what if everybody just limps behind and then, you know, or ace king? Like, what if everyone just limps behind and then I end up playing ace king in, like, a 10-way limped pot? Okay, not great, but, like, what if you raise to 25 and four people call and now you're out of position and you're holding ace king and you've got five big blinds in the pot instead of one? Like, yeah, I mean, the scenarios where nobody raises and you don't get the chance to get your limp raise in are bad, but the point is, like, what you're giving up by missing out on this particular, like, here, we've flopped top pair, top kicker, and it's still, like, I don't think our implied odds are that high. You know, I mean, like, I mean, we're a favorite to win, or not a favorite, but I mean, we're going to win the pot more often than anyone else. You know, in a five-way pot, we're maybe going to win like 25 to 30% of the time, and, you know, we should be able to get one more bet in there at least with, you know, as somewhat of a favorite. But this is not like an equity bonanza sort of spot.
No. And like, just from a fundamental, even more fundamental than all that, like, if you're playing sufficiently deep stacked, how bad is it? Like, let's say your opponents are really good and you're playing deep stack, no limit hold'em. How big a mistake is it to fold dark under the gun?
Right.
Not that big. I mean, it's clearly wrong, but it's not that bad. It's like, and like, I also have a bit of personal history here, which I played a very, very long session once in an uncapped no limit game at the old in the old room at Caesar's Palace. And I was playing against a guy who literally opened for five big blinds with a tight range. In this uncapped game, we were like hundreds and hundreds, like maybe 1,000. No. Three, four. I think we were 500 big blinds deep. And I just remember thinking, like, every time this guy opened, it's like, oh, he's giving me money. Like, like, he's just like, he didn't play that well after the flop. He just thought that he could sit in a uncapped no limit game and make big raises with good hands and then wait to flop top boat and, you know, get some tourists to give him 300 big blinds. And maybe sometimes that happened, but, like, also he was playing way too tight to be raising so much out of position, you know, in bad positions in an uncapped no limit game. Like, he was just giving me his money. And, like, I'm no deep stacked wizard. Like, I'm not Hollingall here, right?
What a funny example, like, of a dude. I mean, you're not wrong. It's just, like, he hasn't been a thing in the poker world in, like...
I'm not Matt Berkey here. I'm not Matt Berkey here, right? It's at the time it would have been Hollingall, like, that who would have been talked about. Like, it's just, if your opponents are good, and maybe your opponents aren't good, but if your opponents are good, you are giving away your money if you are sitting in a deep stack no limit game and making big raises from early positions.
In terms of c-betting, I think we're kind of on the same page with our correspondent here, but there's one additional bit of information that I didn't give you. He says, my only thought here was that I wanted to size up slightly more than usual. I might typically lead for 50. He says even into multiple callers, although I think multiple callers are more of a reason to use the small size. He says, I sized up mainly because both blinds are stations versus me. Small blind because he's super suspicious and I'm always bluffing. Big blind because he's just a big happy station. So if either or both call, I may want to bet something like 2/3 on the turn. However, when the villain calls first in on this texture, the hairs on my neck stood on end. Our hero bets 70, the villain calls, and both blinds call. And he says, when the villain calls first in on this texture, the hairs on my neck stood on end. Rightly or wrongly, I felt like his call on this sort of dry ace-high board with players behind indicated a reasonable hand. I doubt he's peeling a pocket pair, and I'm immediately feeling defensive, like he's either got something or has a plan to do something.
Wait. Is this guy a bad leg, or is he the kind of guy who calls a single bet on ace-6-5 and, like, automatically can beat ace-king or has a wizard plan to make ace-king terrible? Like, I don't know. I guess there are some people.
He was mostly described as bad leg pre-flop and dangerous post-flop.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there are people like there are people like that, right? Who will just, like, once they're the aggressor, just, like, keep on, you know, throwing money in the pot. but like if they're the caller, then they have a lot more. It's just, I don't know. Like, really? Really? I don't know. Okay. I mean, they're like, I guess, why are you worried? Why are you worried? Are you really worried because this specific opponent is likely to have Ace King beat? Or are you worried because it sucks to be out of position this deep in a no-limit hold'em game? I think it's the latter.
Yeah. I mean, I think what he's seeing is that, like, money in the future, like, on the turn and river, the turn and river action is not going to favor him. You know,
yeah.
The, I mean, the villain is not likely to make a lot of mistakes on future streets, and Hero is going to have a difficult time playing his own hand well because it's going to be somewhat. I mean, it's not quite face up, but like he's just going to have top pair a lot, and his opponent's going to know that.
Yes. Okay. Good. 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 But both blinds call. If they're stations, one of them for opponent specific reasons, and one of them because he's just a big stationy station or whatever, then that's wonderful. So like. Again, psychological side of this, it's very scary when you're in a four-handed pot with one pair in no limit hold'em with deep stacks. But if these people are calling any gut shot, any pair, like if you have suspicious station-y people, there are so many ways to make one pair or a gut shot or whatever. And that also protects the pot. So like, if it goes, like let's say the turn's a brick and it goes check, check, then you can just bet again. And bet an amount that suspicious people can still call. Then if the villain raises, like, what? He's trying to blast off into, like, four people? I don't know. Like, he's running a crazy move in this multi-way pot? If so, you know, good for him. You can just fold the ace-king and know that you have nuttier hands to keep him honest with. Like, I agree that it's bad, you know, that, like, the villain can put you in a tough spot and ace-king does not have a lot of value against an opponent who's out of position. Well, isn't it great? Isn't it wonderful? Isn't it a bonanza that two people who you are in position against also call? I think that's great. Really important part of the hand. Okay, good. Let's. What happens on the turn? What happens on the turn?
I want to say one thing on the flop, which is that the concern about like the villain has a plan to do something. I mean, he still needs a hand. Like he's calling with three people still to act by. I mean, so you're betting into four people, which is showing a fair bit of strength. And then this player is calling with three people still to act behind him. Like, I mean, I think Chris is right to have hairs standing up on his neck in the sense that, I mean, even just when the original villain calls, I'll just repeat my point. Like, I don't think he can be peeling with King Jack of Diamonds. I mean, he would have to be a very bad leg to be doing that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, is he peeling with 7-6? Yes. Is he peeling with 9-8 for a gut shot? Yes. Especially a 9-8 and a backdoor flush drop. But, like,
I mean, maybe. A lot of people won't. Like, even, sure. Maybe not. Sure.
But I just mean, like, so, I mean, to just say, like, he has a plan is, I mean, he has to have something also. He can't just have a plan of, I'm just going to peel here with, like, whatever two cards I feel like. I mean, he still is pretty constrained in what he can do. And I think it's important to, like, keep that in consideration.
Yeah, very good, yes.
So the turn is the deuce of clubs. There's 400 in the pot. Our hero is holding ace-king, and the board is ace-6-5-deuce-rainbow. Both blinds check. What do you want to do?
I want to bet. 4-3 suited got there, but 4-3 offsuit probably isn't in. It's a pretty bricky brick. Like, I mean, given that deuces, threes, fours, fives, sixes, sevens, eights, nines, and probably also queens and jacks, given that those all improve likely hands, you know, I'd say the deuce of clubs, that's pretty good. Does that put up a backdoor flush draw?
No, it's a rainbow board.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Deuce of clubs, that's it's a pretty good turn card. I think you can bet. I think you can bet. I think you should bet. I think you don't want to give a free card. I think even though, like, this is a pretty rare spot where you still want to bet one pair for value in a four-way pot in a deep stacked hand of no limit hold'em. But this is one of those spots I would bet, and like 40% of the pot, if I'm keeping the stacks and everything straight, sounds about right to me.
You are very much on the same page as Chris, who bet 150. The 160 would be 40% of the pot.
How'd Chris and I do, Andrew?
I like it. I mean, I think you're right that you want to keep betting here. Your hand is not... I mean, you're going to be very unhappy if you get raised. A lot of the hands that are going to call a second bet here, well, I mean, there are some. So, like, the best case scenario is someone has ace, queen, or ace, jack. You're a huge favorite against that hand. They are going to call. Better players can find a fold if you blast it for 300 or 400 on the turn. But you know, for 150, I think you do get paid by the hands that you dominate. And, I mean, you're also getting peeled by stuff that you're, where, like, I mean, you're ahead on the turn, but you're, when I say behind on the river, I mean, they're going to make better decisions than you on the river. So you're going to get peeled by stuff like 5-4, which...
Yeah, 5-4, 6-4, 6-4 suited, like a lot of those pair and gutter hands. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, the river is going to be an uncomfortable situation. It's going to be, I mean, it's going to be more than uncomfortable if you get raised on the turn. I think you... I mean, against most people, you just fold if you get raised on the turn. I'm not sure about, I mean, and that's more of an exploitive thing, because most people are just going to have it when they raise you on the turn, especially, you know, keep in mind 4-3 got there. So if someone is in the pot with 4-3, that's now a straight. And I think it's just like, it's hard. I'm so like the best players will find the raise with like 5-4 or 6-4 and kind of put the pressure on you. A lot of people are just going to call with those hands.
Yeah.
So I'm not as sure about the main villain. You know, it sounds like our correspondent knows him well enough. Maybe they can just make that decision.
Yeah, that's right. So, but like the first villain would have to raise into three people, as we've already discussed. I'll say if it's exactly the last person in the live dynamic, sometimes that person just says like, screw it, it's just me and him now. And I think the other guy might not have it. Like, I'm all in. Like that happens sometimes. But like, yeah, if the main villain... raises, then it's an easy fold unless you want to make an exploitive call. And if you want to make an exploitive call, you make an exploitive call. And the small blind's a tougher spot, but probably a fold. Then the big blind, you have to decide. Given that he said, like, he's just a big stationy station, I might make him show me a hand here. But, you know, do what you will. And it makes a big difference that he's the last guy alive if in the case where he's raising you.
But you know, the point here is, like, even though it's going to be uncomfortable if you get raised, or downright bad if you get raised, that doesn't mean you should check.
Yeah, it's also like it's going to be uncomfortable if you check too.
Right.
Possibly even worse. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people just have the idea of, you know, don't bet if you don't want to get raised. And that's very incorrect. Like, in fact, it's almost the opposite. Like, most people don't raise as much as they should in this spot. Like, it's not entirely a coincidence that I used this, you know, when I was talking about the game theory book back at the beginning of the show, this example of, you know, people don't really know what to do against people who are betting turns too aggressively. Like, most people don't raise as much as they probably should. So, like, a good exploit against people who do not raise very aggressively on the turn is to bet like a more linear range on the turn. And kind of by definition, a linear range contains a lot of hands that are going to be unhappy if they get raised. A polarized range doesn't mind getting raised. A polarized range is like either you have very strong hands and you're like, hey, he just raised me and I have the nuts, awesome. Or you have a very weak hand and you're like, oh, well, he didn't go for it, I fold. Linear ranges contain a lot of hands like, you know, top pair or draws and stuff like that that are going to be in okay shape when they're called, that will benefit to some degree from hands that the opponent folds. But that really do not want to get raised. And against people who are not going to raise as much as they should, then if anything, you want to be doing even more betting with this kind of hand. But I think even at equilibrium, I would guess, I mean, it's hard to talk about equilibrium in four-way pots, but I would guess that you're doing some betting with this hand anyway. Like, you are still a favorite against a lot of stuff that's going to call you, and you're just going to have to deal with it on the river.
Well said, well said.
So the river... Oh, so here's Chris's analysis of the turn bet. Despite the calls from the blinds, I decide to use a smaller sizing. I think it's a more appropriate general sizing, and given my instinctive flinch at the villain's flop flat, I think it's the right way to go. I don't particularly like giving up the lead here. Check calling makes my hand fairly face up, I think, and I think his calling range will be bigger than his betting range, just given the number of opponents. Plus 4-3 gets there, and I'm likely to bet fold to any action from any of the three. I think that's pretty consistent with what we've said. So the river is the king of spades. There's now only the villain calls. So the hero bets 150 and only the main villain calls. So those two players in the blinds fold. There's now 700 in the pot on the river. And the final board is ace, six, five, deuce, king, rainbow. So our hero rivers two pair. There's 700 in the pot. We're heads up against the hijack here. What do you want to do?
So, I mean, our hand is good. Not a lot better in terms of, like the probability that, like, the king doesn't change much in terms of whether we're ahead or behind. Mm-hmm. One nice thing about the king is that there are fewer combinations from villain's perspective of ace-king to exist. So, hooray for that. I think, given the description, like, I think we should figure we're ahead and try to figure out how we're going to get the most money in the pot. I'm not sure a lot of people are just going to bluff at this. Like, is he really just calling with a draw, and then he's going to bluff at you on the river? Like, he's just calling the turn with a naked, open-ended draw that he didn't raise with on the flop? I mean, it's possible, but, like, I don't know if he's going to bluff that. I mean, he's not going to call with it, so it's better to check against that hand. I personally can be bluffing here sometimes. This is a spot where I like to run bluffs, but one of the reasons I run bluffs is that I get a lot of folds. This is also a spot where, like, especially against a regular opponent, what I do is so exploitive, usually. Like, it's just, it has so much to do with, like, how he called the flop, that I don't have a lot to say in general on the river. But, like, don't check just because you're scared. Like, I would say, you know, do whatever you would do if you had the best hand. And, like, even people who fit this description, some of them are better to bet against, and some of them are better to check against. I would say my default would be to bet, but, yeah, I mean, he can have an ace. He can get suspicious with that ace. I would bet and try to get value against a suspicious one pair hand. You know, so 40% of the pot sounds good, roughly. But that's not very exciting. What would you do?
I do think it's a bet. I mean, I think it's the way Chris summed it up. On the turn, I think is applicable here on the river as well, which is that his calling range is going to be bigger than his betting range. I mean, as you implied, Nate, the reason to check and call would be to induce bluffs. And I think a lot of the hands, if villain wanted to bluff, like, a lot of his bluff candidates would have raised before now. I think, like, having position on you and you know, knowing everything that we said about how difficult it is for you to have really not, like, the fact that even ace king is going to be uncomfortable when it gets raised on the flop or turn is a pretty good reason for him to raise if he is sitting there holding, like, 8-7 or 5-4 or 6-4 or whatever. Or he's just a passive player and he's not going to bluff with those, period. I don't think it's that likely that he call, like, this player description just doesn't sound like one who calls to the river and then, like, desperation bluffs when you check to him. It sounds like he's going to make a savvier, more leveraged bluff if he wants to bluff with those hands. So I would really take check calling off the table. I would like, if I somehow accidentally checked, I mean, I guess the main reason to call would be the chance that villain has, like, a worse two pair that he's value betting. So, I mean, if I were, like, forced to check, I would probably make a decision based on the sizing of whether I even wanted to call in the first place. I think you're right that rivering the king really doesn't do that much to improve our hand. I mean, I think maybe, like, ace deuce is the most likely hand where it matters, where, like, he didn't have two pair on the flop. He turned, you know, a not great two pair, chose not to raise with it. Yeah, it's just, I think it's hard to construct a scenario where he has two pair. I think a lot of them raise the flop or turn. Whether or not they should, I think most people do raise with them at some point. I don't think it matters terribly much that you have two pair. I think in theory, this is a pretty good spot to bet small. It's hard for you. So, like, the bigger you bet, the more bluffs that you need to give your opponent incentive to call you with bluff catchers, and it's pretty hard for you to have bluffs here, I think. You know, you would have had to bet the flop into four people, bet the turn into three people. It's just, there's just not that much you can have. I guess you can have, like, maybe four combos of 8-7 suited that missed. Maybe you have some 5-4 suited in your range. It's pretty hard for you to have bluffs in this spot. So I think that you should be sizing pretty small in theory. One of the problems with that is that a lot of people struggle to find small bets when they have strong hands. So, like, if our hero did have, like, pocket aces or something here, I think a lot of people think of the river as, like, well, it's my last chance to get value. Even if they bet small on previous streets, they tend to bet big. And so when you do bet small, a lot of opponents correctly read that as exactly the sort of hand that you have. Like, a lot of people don't bet quarter pot as, or third pot as bluffs. A lot of people don't bet that small when they have very strong hands on the river. And so the result is, you know, even if you would in theory have a balanced range, in this case, you do have a hand that's going to be uncomfortable if raised. And your opponent may correctly respond to that by turning a hand into a bluff, even if it was one that he might have, you know, tried to show down against a check or something. It would be my main concern. But I still think you have to start by betting small. And I guess, like, for all of that, I still think a lot of people just don't bluff raise the river that well, and I would probably still fold to a raise.
Yeah, I mean, what to do against a raise is tricky. Like, on the one hand, people aren't really bluffing. On the other hand, like, a lot of people really are never just calling the flop and also just calling the turn with a hand that can beat ace king here. So, you know, it's like which thing that never happens is actually happening. And then you just have to guess. And that's fine. You know, welcome to poker. Yeah, but I would bet small, not too small.
So as you might guess from all my talk about what to do if raised, the hero bets 250. And the villain raises to 850.
Huh. That's bad. And again, I'm doing this blind. 250 was how much of the pot?
There was 700 in the pot.
Yeah. That's bad. 700 plus 500 is 1,200. And we're getting raised another 600. A half pot raise. We need to be right a quarter of the time to call. That's bad. This is a bad spot. I'm glad I don't make it 5x before the flop with ace king. Yeah, I mean, I think I call because, like, did he really just flat the turn and the flop with a hand that can beat ace king? Maybe he did, but he doesn't need to be getting desperate that often. A lot of draws missed, and he can also talk himself into calling the turn with a draw. Yeah. And I'm bluffing here sometimes. I think if I'm me, this is a good call. yeah, I mean, you don't like it. And yeah, like it's a money losing call, but not as much as like it's you don't win on the action that goes in, but it's better than folding. So I'm pretty comfortable calling here, but you don't want to be out of position in a big bet game a lot. But yeah, I call. Boom. That's my decision. I'm doing this blind.
Let me just clarify what you mean by money losing call. I know you
said that. Yeah, sorry. No,
right. So
yeah,
it's like you're calling because of the pot odds, not because you expect to win more than 50% of the time.
Yes, that's right. Yes. I expect to be ahead as me against a villain like this with this action between 25 and 50% of the time. Yes.
I think it's close to 25. Like, you know, I think this is probably, I mean, it's like in theory you're probably supposed to be like this is the sort of hand that your opponent's probably trying to make you indifferent with when he raises the river.
I should say if the flop was even three-handed, I would fold happily. Like if this were a heads-up pot, it's an easy fold, I think. Like specifically in a four-handed pot and specifically in like the way the games I play like this, like I would love to give you a perfect game theory answer, but so much of this hand was multi-way that like you just can't do that. Yeah. Like it makes a big, big difference. And like it's a funny spot where a hand being more multi-way makes me like one pair of hands more. It's very funny. Like it's just so much easier for him to like say like, oh, I'll peel the turn with my draw, and like he's really gonna sit there with pocket fives. And there's this like other thing where like really this guy was sitting there with a set and my spidey sense didn't go off at all, so like I'm also putting myself into Chris's spot where he's saying like I guess he did get worried.
Did have a spidey sense.
Okay, well then I fold. Okay. then I fold. But like, you know, just like as yeah, I mean, but then it's like without spidey sense, I call. With spidey sense, I fold. And like, that's not a very satisfying thing to say on a podcast. It's like, oh, I would do, you know, I would call if I'm going to win, and I would fold if I'm not going to win. But like, you know, it's a multi-way pot. I think the like really important sort of game invariant thing is to remember that this was a four-handed pot, five-handed pot pre-flop, four-handed pot on the flop. That's what's important here.
And I mean, the other not very satisfying thing to say is that it probably is pretty close to break even, especially without Spidey sense. Like, it's just a close decision, and you can spend a lot of time like fretting over those, and you know, especially once you know the results, you can feel like if you fold and he shows you a bluff, you feel stupid. If you call and he shows you a value hand, you feel stupid. But like, the truth is, it's just like a close decision, and you're probably not in terms of like how you could be spending your poker study time, like fretting over, because people want to, because these are like big pots and big decisions, and like their results would have swung hundreds of dollars one way or the other based on what they did here. But that's all like after the fact knowledge.
I
think like the more interesting decisions really are the earlier streets, and like getting the small sizing right on the flop and turn, knowing you're supposed to bet the turn anyway. I think those are actually the more important decisions than what you do here on the river. There's not a lot of good options either for your first action on the river betting, and also, you know, especially when faced with a raise, there's just, you know, it's just a bad spot to be in, and it doesn't mean you did anything wrong to get into that spot. It just happens sometimes.
Yep. All right, I'm curious what happened.
Okay. Chris says, my immediate thought in the aftermath of the hand was that, the villain raises to 850, Chris calls, and he says, my immediate thought in the aftermath of the hand was that I think I like check call better on this river. When we bet, regardless of sizing.
You just said you lost a big pot. I got this wrong. And probably also the Spidey sense thing. Like, I'm not saying anything about Chris, but like, did you really have Spidey sense at the time, or are you just sad you lost a huge pot? I mean, and I don't mean that condescendingly. Like, when I lose a pot this big, I think like, fuck, too. You know, like, it's not like, you know, I'm not trying to be condescending here. But like, anyway, yeah, no, don't check through. No. Bet the river. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
When we bet, regardless of sizing, our hand looks like what it is, ace-king. Not to say villain will play perfectly against this, but I think, for example, the king limits the number of second-best hands that may raise river, but all of them will bet for us as we slightly under-rep our hand when we check. I don't buy that. I don't think ace-queen is betting the river.
No.
And we avoid having to pay off a very difficult raise with a hand that sort of feels like top of our range, but probably isn't, and also blocks some of what we want to get value from, but still feels too strong to just bet fold. Yeah, I mean, I know what you mean, but like, you don't really make these decisions just based on the absolute strength of your hand. Like, if you think the villain is just only raising sets, straights, and bluffs, it doesn't matter that you have, it doesn't matter that ace king is a stronger hand than ace queen.
Yeah. And also, like, if you did check the river, if the other guy like sort of checked confidently behind and like confidently tabled ace queen, you'd be thinking like, fuck, like, of course he has one pair. He would have raised the turn with the set. Like, you would think like, oh, like, is he ever like sitting down with a set all this time? Like, why didn't I value bet that river? Like, I could have ace 10, you know, I would have protected my hand on the turn. Anyway. Yeah, no, bet the river.
Results are predictable. And I don't think this is predictable. I mean, I think it's predictable that he lost, but the exact hand he lost to. Villain had 4-3 offsuit for the slow played nuts, which, I mean, I know he was described as like a bad lag preflop, but I think that's a, even for a bad lag, that's a bad preflop call.
Yeah, it's like super, super, yeah, it's not good. It's not good. And then, like, also, yes, like, man. So when I think about the nutty hands the villain can have, like specifically 4-3, like that's a hand that can exactly call on the flop, then has the minimum amount to fear on the turn. Although, like, you know, if an 8 rolls off, is he that have, you know, it's just, if the 7-6 gets the 5-5-4-3-5-6-7-8, if the 7-8 gets there on the river, is he that happy with, you know, that's trick. Anyway, like, I can see why he would call the flop and call the turn with that hand. The board's rainbow exactly on the turn, giving him a little more reason in his eyes to just call the turn. But like, man, that is not a predictable result. Makes me like calling a little better, actually. Like, if he has 4-3 offsuit, then he has he probably has a lot of other stuff. Like, a guy who calls the flop
offsuit, if nothing, I mean, that has to go somewhere.
Yeah, it has to go somewhere. Then all those, like, pair plus draw hands. No. Oh, and also, like, bet the river. Like, yeah, this is a good lesson. Like, if he gets to the river, he had a straight on the turn. Like, some of these people do fold all their hands on the turn, and then they're wonderful people to play against. Like, they call preflop with everything. They feel the flop with everything, and then they just fold it all on the turn. But, like, assuming he gets to the river with some of those zillions and zillions of hands that he plays, like, a lot of them have a pair, and we'll check behind if you check, but we'll call sometimes if you bet. So, yeah, 4-3. Yeah, you lost a big pot. I'm sorry you lost a big pot. And but thank you for writing in. Thank you for writing in, Chris.
And other people who want to share hands with us, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Feeling ashamed, spread too thin, and hoping for a sin, na-na, for a word that could take away the pain. Sleepless nights, do I need some kind of pill? Or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't, you won't.